Key. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 12:30 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Nice to have you with us on a Tuesday. Very nice day. Not quite as picture-perfect at the moment as it was for most of the morning. We have a few more clouds, but they appear to be of the puffy white variety. So I don't think there's any real danger there. And, you know, every once in a while, a few clouds are kind of nice. Temperature has climbed into the low 70s. We don't expect it to get a great deal warmer today. It's a very pleasant day. Last few hours of spring. Yeah, summer arrives. Tomorrow's the first day of summer. And actually, according to the astronomers, believe me, I don't figure this out. Astronomers say the summer solstice will occur at exactly 24 minutes past midnight tonight. So, first day of summer today for us. Where the Pirates are in Milwaukee, first day of summer is today. Because of the time difference, yeah, it'll actually be 11:24 in Milwaukee in the central time zone. So, summer actually arrives on Tuesday. And it's that way in different parts of the world. This happens every so often when the seasons change. You either have a solstice or an equinox right around midnight because, obviously, 24 time zones around the world. So some of them will be one day and some will be another. For us, summer arrives shortly after midnight. Summer solstice. It's when the sun reaches its northernmost point with relation to Earth. And it starts back down the other way. And we don't like to think about that because it means that eventually, in a few weeks, our days are going to start getting shorter again. I don't know about you. I love the long days. And, you know, maybe if it was this way all year round, maybe it wouldn't be so special. But if you get a clear morning, such as we had this morning, yesterday, of course, it was dark and dreary and pouring down rain at daybreak. But this morning, it was clear as a bell. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. And you could there was pre-dawn light even before 5 o'clock this morning. Sunrise, technically, was around 5:48, 5:47, 5:48. And it's really great to see daylight at that early hour. And at the other end of the day, it's almost 9 o'clock, just a few minutes before 9 tonight for sundown. Last night, skies had cleared after another go-round of showers and thunderstorms in the early evening. But the skies had cleared, and we had twilight even up close to 10 o'clock last night. That's a great time of the year. You won't see a great deal of change for a few weeks. We'll pretty much stay where we are. And then ever so gradually, the daylight hours will start shortening again. But we prefer not to talk about that. Huh? Yeah. Hey, it's Open Talk on the first portion of the program today. Our phone number is 283-2525, 283-2525. We will have guests with us later on the program today. We are going to be talking about the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The civil rights era. This has come up in conversation and in the news a few times over the past couple of weeks. And a good time to take a look back at that era. Who are we talking to about the United States military? It was just within the past week or so. I don't know, maybe John McManus, military historian, or maybe just last week when we were talking with Bob Dvorak, military historian. But the United States military was segregated up until after World War II. So even during World War II, in the U.S. military, African-Americans, blacks, were not allowed to serve in the same unit as whites. Unbelievable. And all of these civil rights protections that we now have, and we kind of take for granted, I think, They did not come about until the mid-60s, and they were the result, in some cases, of great tragedy. And that's what we're going to be talking about today with guest Steve Pfeiffer, who will be joining us shortly after 1 o'clock. And we'll be talking about a biography he's written of a couple of guys, not so much a biography of their lives, but what happened with regard to their deaths. Because both of these individuals, Jimmie Lee Jackson and James Reeb, were killed in the South. And that led to a march, and that eventually led to Lyndon Johnson at the time saying, we have to do something, let's pass the Voting Rights Act, civil rights legislation in the mid and late 60s. So we'll talk about that a little bit later on the program today. And also, we just passed, was it last week? I think it was last week. It would have been the 100th birthday of John F. Kennedy. We were talking about that, right? He would have been 100. I forget what day it was. It was one day last week. 100. Wow. Oh. We're going to be talking with Tina Cassidy a little bit about, not JFK, but about Jackie Kennedy. Jackie Kennedy and her life after the death of JFK. So that's coming up a little bit later on the program today. But first thing we do is open talk, and our phone number is 283-2525, 283-2525. So let's get to the people. Hi, caller. Dave Malarkey here. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you?
With this being the first day of summer, I was just wondering what your bucket list vacation would be. Or maybe you've already taken it.
Well, that's kind of interesting because I was actually thinking about that. I have accomplished some of the things on my bucket list. I don't actually have a list. I suppose I should write it down. Excuse me. I keep it kind of in my head. But I was thinking to myself, I wonder if I want to revisit a few places that I've been to, you know? One of them would be Paris. I haven't been to Paris in quite a while. I thought, you know, maybe I should go back. The City of Light. What stops you and what makes you think is the violence that's been going on in Europe, you know?
Absolutely.
For the past year or so, London and Paris, Brussels, Germany, most of the major cities have been the victims of terrorist attacks, and makes you think a little bit. There was just another incident in Paris last week where somebody went after one of the police officers with a hammer outside the Cathedral of Notre Dame. So,
right.
I don't know. But that's that would be, I'm going to tell you, Paris is a beautiful city. I was laughing at myself because I was telling somebody this story. You don't mind if I bend your ear for a second, do you?
No.
The first time I went to Paris, I didn't speak a word of French. This did not deter me. I have a bit of a sense of adventure about this. And by the way, I was by myself. I was by myself. And I got there, and okay, I'm fine. I got a hotel room. I'm okay. And I went to find a place to eat. And there was a place on one of the streets. Is called the Rue de Rivoli. It's actually a pretty fancy street. It runs past the Louvre Museum. But I was walking down that street, and there was a cafe. It was called the American Cafe. It was painted on the window in front. I thought, oh, I'm in luck. I don't speak any French. I'm in luck. So I went in. It was a French cafe. They just called it the American Cafe, I guess, I don't know, to draw tourists in. Nobody spoke English. And so I had my first experience of trying to order something from a menu that I knew nothing. I ended up with eggs and Pepsi. That's a true story. I'm not kidding. True story. But here's the really funny part. For the next 3 days, I ate at that same restaurant because that's the only place I knew that I could go. And I knew what I was going to be getting. And then finally I said, okay, enough of this, man. Let's straighten up and enjoy Paris. Now, I was going around. I was seeing the Eiffel Tower and Notre Dame and all the stuff you want to see. But I did for 3 days in a row. I had lunch in the same restaurant. Oh, my. I didn't mean to make that story so long, but I was laughing about it the other day when I was thinking about it.
Enjoy hearing.
What about
you? Do you ever want to take a cruise?
Well, I've never done that. I have friends. I got to wipe my eyes here. I got tears. I was laughing so hard at myself. Oh, my. I wonder if that restaurant's still there. I've never gone on a cruise. Have you?
I have not, but that is my bucket list.
I'm not sure that I would want to do an ocean cruise. I think what might intrigue me would be those. Have you seen the commercials on TV for the river cruises?
Oh, yes.
I think it's Viking. I think that's the Viking line is the one I remember anyway. But they go up and down the Rhine and the Danube and, some of the large rivers in Europe. That looks like it would be fun.
Now, I have an opportunity, and that's the reason I was thinking of this, next 2018 to leave from New Jersey, the port of New Jersey, and the first stop is Boston, and then up to, I believe, Portland, Maine, and the last stop is Halifax, Nova Scotia, and then back down to New Jersey. It's a 9-day cruise.
And you're doing that next year, you say?
Possibly, yes, next 2018.
I have friends, a group of friends, actually, who took a similar cruise a year or so ago. They sailed out of Boston. They flew to Boston, sailed, and went to Portland, Maine, started up the eastern coast, Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, and they went all the way up to the mouth of the St. Lawrence and then turned and sailed up the St. Lawrence the whole way to Quebec.
Wow.
And they loved it. They loved it. And then flew back to Pittsburgh from Quebec. And they said it was a fabulous trip.
Well, my son is quite the history major, whatever, and so I'm hoping that he gets to go along, and we go as a family, and I'm going to let him be my tour guide through Boston and some of those cities up along the New England coast.
That sounds like it would be a great trip. Do you have any idea what time of the year you're going to go?
Possibly August.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be nice. It's still going to be warm, you know.
Right.
Some people take that trip in the autumn with the leaves, but I don't know. Then it's kind of iffy, you know. What if you get really cold weather? Who wants to be out on the Atlantic Ocean in freezing cold, you know?
Right. Well, and the thing is, I always wanted to go on a cruise, but I'm not sure whether I'll get seasick or not. Mm-hmm. So this one, what I liked about it is if you look at it on a map, you really don't go that far out into the water. The furthest out into the water you're going to go is when you leave Halifax, Nova Scotia, to come back down to New Jersey.
Yeah, that's not bad.
The others are just kind of like bumping up along the coast.
That's not bad. No.
Right.
All righty. Well, good luck. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Enjoy your vacation.
Will do. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
283-2525 is our number. Open talk on the program today. 283-2525. Riding trains is nice. That's kind of fun. There's not too many opportunities to do that here in the U.S., although, as a matter of fact, our good friends at Butler Motor Tours, they offer some combination bus and train trips that are kind of fun. They do several of those in the fall. Yeah. Trains are nice. I've had the opportunity to ride trains. I've never been on an ocean-going vessel. Crossed the Irish Sea on a large ferry, but that would not be a boat that you'd want to, you know, head out across the Pacific Ocean on. I've never been on one of those big cruise ships. They look monstrous. In fact, when you see pictures of them, I'm talking about the big ones now that, you know, go down to the Caribbean and so on. They look to me like they could tip over. Because, you know, they got 17 decks on those babies. And they, obviously, they're very stable, but they don't look it to me. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. Open talk on the program today. What are people talking about in the national news? The mistrial declared in the Bill Cosby case this past weekend after a trial in suburban Philadelphia and 5 days and 52 hours of deliberation by a jury. They claimed they were hopelessly deadlocked on the three counts of aggravated indecent assault against Cosby. And so the judge declared a mistrial. And immediately the prosecutor said they're going to bring it again. They're going to have a new trial. And the judge said we're going to do this in just a few months. Get it going. I don't know. The mistrial, the lack of a verdict, I think came as a surprise to a lot of people who, I mean, I didn't follow the case that closely. Quite frankly, the allegations against Cosby, and of course, it was only this one case that was on trial, but there have been many, 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 many allegations by many, many women against him, and, you know, I find it pretty disgusting, to be honest with you. I'm not interested in paying that close attention to it. It's slimy. But the mistrial, I think, caught a lot of people by surprise. A lot of folks kind of thought it would be a slam dunk against him. Of course, a lot of people thought it would be a slam dunk to find O.J. Simpson guilty, too, in the murder of his wife, Nicole Simpson, and the other gentleman that she was with. And we all know how that turned out. 283-2525 is our number. Open talk on the It's Your Turn program today. 283-2525. Another bug is eating trees in Pennsylvania. You got to wonder when this is going to stop. Saw a story in the Post-Gazette on Sunday. Some kind of moth. When I first saw moth, I thought, oh, no. Don't tell me that the gypsy moth is making a big comeback. Now, this is called the cherry. I'm not making this up. The cherry scallop shell moth, which defoliates mainly black cherry trees and some other native cherries. Bugs are amazing. And we had the emerald ash borer that first popped onto the scene about 5 years ago, only eating ash trees. And look how quickly, I mean, that has just devastated. I don't know if there's any ash trees left in Pennsylvania. Even if you drive along the roadway, pick any highway, and you'll see the dead trees along the road, sometimes whole stands of them. They're ash trees that have been killed by the emerald ash borer. In fact, one of the utility companies, West Penn Power, announced this spring that they were dedicating dedicated crews going around this summer, beginning to take down these dead ash trees, the ones that are endangering power lines. Because eventually, you know, once they've been dead for a few years, they begin to weaken and rot, and they come down in windstorms. And West Penn is worried about them taking out power lines. So they're making a concentrated effort this summer to go around and take down as many of the thousands and thousands of these dead ash trees that they think might, within the next year or two, imperil electric lines. And when you see them along the roadway, you can understand the concern because, I mean, they're everywhere. Dead trees. Now we have the cherry scallop shell moth, which eats the leaves of cherry trees. Black cherry. I'm not too up to date on cherries. I can identify certain trees. I guess most people can, right? Maple, oak, sycamore. But cherry trees, I just, you know, cherry trees, huh? When I was a kid, we called them choke cherries. Are those black cherries? I don't know. You couldn't eat the cherries, I know that. But anyway, we got this moth now, and it's becoming more and more prevalent in the Allegheny National Forest. That's great. One of the gorgeous places we have up in north central Pennsylvania. Have you ever been there? Boy, is that nice. Nice. I'll tell you another place that's nice, even closer. Cook Forest. Cook Forest State Park. Have you ever been there? When we were kids, our family and my siblings, we used to camp there. And pretty much every summer, sometimes a couple of times. Go up there and pitch a tent. And there's fond memories of that place. You talk about peaceful, quiet, cooler. Even when you started to drive into Cook Forest, much cooler. And then perhaps the most significant thing that I remember, aromatic. And you wind down the windows in the car, and as soon as you start into Cook Forest, you can smell the pines. And it's not air freshener chemical smell either. It's real pine smell. I got to get up there again. Not to camp out, but maybe just to spend the day. Good times. Take a canoe down the Clarion. Nice. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. We are awaiting the release, and it's supposed to happen this afternoon. I didn't realize it was so quickly, but state officials are expected to announce the individuals who are going to be licensed to grow medical marijuana. Remember a couple of weeks ago, we had the folks on from Butler who have proposed a growing operation here in the city of Butler for medical marijuana. There are a limited number of licenses that are going to be permitted, and the announcement is supposed to be this afternoon, so we'll keep an eye on Harrisburg for that news. Open talk at 283-2525. Hi, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Good afternoon.
Hi. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Oh, it's nice to talk to you.
Oh, thank you. My husband was stationed in Australia and New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
During World War II, and the natives would say, oh, you've got to come back after the war, you know, and visit. Well, we did. I was very disappointed.
Really?
Yes. In fact, what I enjoyed, we stayed at the Hyatt and places like that, you know, which was something for me, something new, and I enjoyed that. But they would put us on buses and take us out to the country to see the animals and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They were just like in zoos or along the highway in somebody's farm.
Nothing special, huh?
Kangaroos or something, you know, as a pet.
Yeah, yeah.
There was nothing special. What I enjoyed more was staying in the nice hotels, the Hyatt and Regency. So,
what branch of the service was your husband in World War II?
The Army.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he was stationed in Australia, huh? Wow.
Uh-huh. He was in Australia and New Zealand.
Tell me, I have a couple of friends, not too many people, that I know who have ever been there. Did you fly? Did you take a jet?
Not a jet. I think we flew, yes.
Uh-huh. Takes a long time even to fly to Australia. I mean, it is literally halfway around the world.
Well, yeah, we went, I forget whether it was California to get to Australia.
Mm-hmm. Probably that's where you started, yeah.
Yeah. And but I was very disappointed. In fact, what I enjoyed mostly was staying at the Hyatt hotels.
Well, you could have gone to Pittsburgh and stayed in one of the big hotels.
But, I was very disappointed because all they did was put us on buses or take us out, you know, along to see the animals, and a lot of them were in cages and zoos and people's yards as pets. And
what about your husband's reaction? Did he have any feelings about going back to where he had been during the war?
No, he didn't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'd rather go where you could see friends or somebody you knew, you know, that way. But all the friends he had were in the service, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, you didn't fight about this trip, though, did you?
Pardon me?
You didn't argue about it, I mean.
Oh, no.
Okay.
We enjoyed the three good meals a day.
Well, that's one thing, and the only reason I mention that happens sometimes among couples, you know, where there'll be a little bit of a debate about where to go on vacation, and sometimes that can get, you know, kind of ornery.
No. We were. I know. I enjoyed the staying at the Hyatt.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing that with us. That's funny. That's
nice
a good
talking with you.
Good story. No, my pleasure. My pleasure. Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
283-2525 is the number, 283-2525. You don't necessarily have to travel a great distance to enjoy vacation. You know? I've had enormous fun even going just to Canada. I've traveled there many, many times, although almost always to Ontario. In fact, I'm not sure that I've been in any other province in Canada. Our provinces are quite a bit bigger than our states. But it's great fun. You know, you could be in Ontario in really 4 hours from here. And that's not breaking the speed limit. You know, you're a couple of hours up to Erie, and then a couple of more, and you're in Buffalo, and across the Peace Bridge, and there you go, huh? Of course, you need a passport these days, even to go to Canada. Need a passport. 283-2525, our number. Hi, caller. This is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hi, Dave. How you doing?
Pretty good. How are you today?
Good. I'm about 30% proficient on texting.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that LOL means laughing out loud sometimes.
That's true.
And sometimes it means something else. Can you tell me what LOLZ means?
LOLZ. I don't know that one. Some of those acronyms are a little bit risque, but I don't think that one.
Yeah, this is from a priest. I don't think it's risque.
I doubt it then. LOL. Let's see. Laughing out loud.
I tell you what.
Laughing out loud, falling asleep. I don't know. I have no idea what that one means.
Hey, about a year ago, I bought a dictionary from Hallmark, but I lost it since then. But it had about, you know, 5,000 abbreviations. But maybe there's some young people out there listening. They can help us out, huh?
Could be. I'm trying to do a little internet search here, even as we chat, but I can't find it off the top of my head here.
Z does mean going to sleep, doesn't it?
It does. Apparently there's some kind of a game called LOLZ, but I don't see anything here that talks about...
And that's sort of a contradiction to be laughing out loud and sleeping at the same time, isn't it?
It is. It's very much a contradiction, as a matter of fact. here's a...
Okay, hey, have a great day.
Okay, you too. Anybody else know what that is? I don't know. Oh, here's a thing that says L-O-O-Z-A, same as L-O-L, laughing out loud. A-L-O-L, actually laughing out loud. I've never even seen some of these before. A-L-W-P, actual laughter was produced. That's what? Who makes these up? What? 283-2525. I just came across this list. This is texting and messaging abbreviations. CBLTH. CBLTH. Can't breathe, laughing too hard. They're good for a smile, anyway. DOL, dying of laughter. Okay, that's enough. According to this internetslang.com website, caller, LOLZ is the same as laughing out loud. Well, then why put the extra letter on? I don't understand that. Not sure. Well, I'm not real, I don't use Those expressions, I guess I don't use them ever, to be honest with you. And I don't use those little, what are the smiley face things? What are they? Emoticons? Is that what they call them? Emoticons? Do you use those, Pat Parker? No, me neither. No. I don't use them, and I don't appreciate getting them in a text mail either. 283-2525. Hi, caller. This is Dave. How are you?
I'm fine, Dave. And how are you?
Well, just great. Even better now that I'm talking to you.
Well, thank you. I'd like to know if anybody knows how to keep our birds from building a nest in our hanging baskets. We are having problems.
You talking about like on your back porch or something?
Yes, yes.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting because I've never had that problem, and I've had a lot of hanging baskets. Back at my parents' house when I was a kid, my mom had a zillion of them hanging all over the back porch. Now, do you have, let me ask you this, do you have one of those newer baskets that's it's not dirt, it's just like, I don't know how to describe it, it's like mulch?
Yeah, yes.
I'm wondering if that might be the problem.
The attraction.
Yeah, the attraction, because it's like a wire basket filled with mulch, and then your flowers are planted. Yeah.
I'm wondering, we had one that already had the eggs in. Now, my son-in-law has been taking care of it. He's been watering it very, very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
But what do? You let the birds die or do you let your flowers die?
Yeah.
Because it does kill the flowers.
Yeah, and you can't, you move a nest and it's going to be abandoned. You know, you can't bother wildlife.
Right, right.
Hmm. Well, I'm just betting. I have no expertise here. But when I thought about one of those new, and these are newer things, the wire basket with the mulch inside, and they look nice, and obviously they work, but that might be the attraction for the birds. That might be.
Yeah. We have the mulch, but we don't have the wire thing. It's a regular plastic bowls.
I see.
But it's not the wire ones.
Well, maybe maybe some of our listeners will have an idea for you. I can understand your concern. Obviously, you don't want to kill either one, you know.
Right. Yeah. Well, before we had one, and we got the nest before the bird got to lay the eggs,
mm-hmm.
and my son-in-law took it out. And I'm not kidding you, in 2 days, that was rebuilt, a beautiful nest with the mud around it and everything. In 2 days, she had a new nest. So, of course, we left that one there for her.
Mother Nature is amazing. You remember the the bald eagles this spring back in March down in Pittsburgh?
Right.
Where they're the tree that had their nest in it, blew down in a storm.
Yes.
And within a week and a half, they'd build a new nest. And those eagle nests are like 8 feet across. They built a new one that quickly in another tree.
Well, the good Lord knows what he's doing, I guess.
That's for sure. Hey, listen,
right.
maybe some listeners have some tips for you, okay?
All right, thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Any ideas for that lady? 283-2525, 283-2525. Hi, caller, this is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hi, Dave. I heard the lady's problem there. I just called with something that I always do in the flower beds and even above my nightlight coming into the house. They like to, even when the light's on at night, they like to build their nest above the light.
Mm-hmm.
Natural predators work real good. Put some rubber snakes there if she likes snakes.
Ah.
She likes her flowers, whatever, you know. Rubber snakes, even when they're hanging there and they got wind kind of moves them around, they think they're pretty much real and they stay away.
Good idea.
I do that with the flower beds. I get rubber snakes and I'll prop them up on a stick with some fishing line and so they can move around a little bit.
Where,
it works really well.
Where would you find them? Toy department of a store?
Oh, I imagine so.
Yeah. That sounds like
my woman. She gets a little frustrated seeing all them snakes around, but sometimes there might be a live one in there, and you just don't.
Well, that sounds like a good idea to me. I appreciate you taking the time to call, my friend.
Yeah, I was watering the flowers once a couple years back, and I was done watering the flowers, and I seen the flowers still moving. I'm like, what the heck is that? And I pulled the flowers apart, and this big long snake came out of there, and I about jumped out of my shoes because I'm not a snake fan, but. They sure work to keep your flowers alive.
Yeah.
Keeps the grinnies away, too.
Yeah, good point. Hey, thanks
all right,
a lot. Dave. Nice to talk to you. Yeah, thanks. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. 283-2525, open talk. Hi, caller. Dave here. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hi. I live in a condo area, and some of the people was having trouble with robins building their nest above their porch light.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ladies that lived there said to put a red bow, like a Christmas bow, big enough above the light, and it'll scare the robins away. So, and they haven't had any problems with that, so I don't know if that works for all birds or not, but it might be better than having a rubber snake hanging out of it.
Are you talking about a bow, like made out of ribbon?
Yeah, like the big felt ribbons that they use for decorating at Christmas time.
Oh, okay, okay, yeah, like you put them on
a
wreath.
Not a red
or
ribbon, no, that would be big enough for the robins, birds to see that keep them from coming and building nests.
Well, that's interesting. I never heard of that, but if it works for people, then good idea.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Bye.
Thank you. 283-2525, open talk, 283-2525. Hi there, this is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead, it's your turn.
Good afternoon, Dave. How are you?
Just fine. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. I have a suggestion for that lady with her flowers.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard about putting a mirror on your around there. And when the bird comes in, he sees the reflection, and he thinks there's another bird there, and they will not build a nest.
Hmm. Well, that would seem to make sense, but on the other hand, there are some people that put those mirror balls in their bird bath. You know what I'm talking about? Have you ever seen a bird bath with those mirror balls in them? So.
Yeah. But, just maybe a regular mirror would be more distinctive.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And maybe the mirror ball, I don't know. I've never gone up next to one of those things. Maybe you can't see a reflection. Maybe it just reflects the light, and that draws them to the bird bath. I don't know.
Uh-huh. But that's what I've heard that works.
Well, hey, yeah, heck, you could pick up one of those in the cosmetic department at any store, you know, a little 2x2-inch mirror, and give it a try. What the heck?
Yeah, I could sit it in there and
they can't hurt anything.
Themselves in there, they won't build a nest.
Probably get one of those for less than $1, so it'd be worth a try, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for sharing. Good idea.
Okay.
Thank you, my friend.
As it works.
Yeah, thanks. I've heard, speaking of bird reflections, I've heard birds attacking their own reflection in a window. Have you heard about that? Well, they think it's, you know, another bird. Of course, I've also heard birds flying into windows because they don't see them. I think they can fly through it, so who knows. The most interesting thing I was reading about birds and sight was in who's the genius, the whiz-bang that writes in Parade magazine every Sunday? Marilyn Von Savant, is that her name? You never read that column, Pat? You never read her? She's like, you know, this, I don't know, brainiac, or says she is anyway. But she was talking this past Sunday, I think that's where I saw this, about somebody asked her, how can birds see straight ahead whenever their eyes are on the sides of their head? That's something that I never actually thought about before. And she said, birds have evolved, most birds, with eyes on the side of their head because they need to see oncoming danger, okay, from both sides. And they have very limited straight-ahead vision, but there's just enough. Kind of like we have peripheral vision. You know, we can see off to the side a little bit. They can see to the front a little bit to get around and, find worms and stuff. But most of their action is so that they can look both sides and even a little bit behind them in case of danger coming. I would have never thought about that for the next 100 years if I hadn't read about it in her column in the Parade magazine. One more call, 283-2525. Caller, this is Dave, and you've got the last word on Open Talk here today. Go right ahead.
Well, hi, Dave. Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on the bird thing.
Yes.
I was driving down Equestrian Road doing 35 miles an hour,
mm-hmm.
and I had a blackbird fly right into the side of my face.
Your face?
Yeah.
Why?
It flew right in my window.
Oh,
right
my goodness.
Inside the driver's window, yeah. And it, lo and behold, it actually died, and I didn't know this till later, Because of the smell, obviously, but it fell onto my the back seat on the floor.
Were you hurt?
Yeah, flew right into my face.
Were you hurt?
Oh yeah, it smarted. Yeah,
but I could imagine.
No permanent damage or anything. But it was just a little blackbird.
I think I'd have a heart attack.
I almost did myself. I was surprised. I managed control of my car.
Yeah.
But right into my side of my face, hurt my ear, and the beak hit my ear, and like I said,
my gosh,
it bounced off and died in the back seat.
First time for everything, huh?
Well, you know what? I'm sorry to leave you on that note,
okay.
I just was listening to your show, had that share
that's
that.
That's a strange story. Hey, thanks, my friend. Thanks very much.
Okay.
Bye bye. I've had birds that will swoop. That just miss your car, and actually sometimes they're coming right at you. When should you kind of duck? And you realize it swooped away. And I know people that have had turkeys, and this is certainly no laughing matter, that have hit their car. I've had a couple that have swooped off a bank and come pretty darn close to me. I haven't had one hit me, thank goodness. Now those babies are big, wild turkeys. Okay, we have to clear the decks here because we're going to be chatting with our first guest in just a couple of minutes. We're going to be talking about the era when civil rights were not yet, the Civil Rights Acts, several of them were not yet passed here in the United States. This all happened during the mid and late 1960s. We're going to be talking about, Steve Pfeiffer is our guest, about two individuals, probably don't know their names, Jimmie Lee Jackson and James Reeb. They both, unfortunately, were killed. One African-American, one white. And it was their deaths, tragically, that led to a march. March to Selma, and eventually to the Voting Rights Act. It's a fascinating story. We'll talk about it with Steve Pfeiffer coming up next on the It's Your Turn program on WISR. Back after these words. We are speaking with physical medicine and rehabilitation specialist Dr. Edward Reedy from Tri-Rivers Surgical. Dr. Reedy, when should someone with neck pain seek treatment?
In terms of patients who are experiencing neck pain, they should see their doctor if they're over 50 and the symptoms last greater than 1 month, or if there's any new onset of pain in the arms associated with the neck pain. These would indicate perhaps more serious neurologic conditions that will probably require some testing. There's a variety of treatment options for chronic neck pain, starting with simple things such as physical therapy or anti-inflammatory medicines, and culminating occasionally with the need for injections or surgical intervention.
To learn more, call Tri-Rivers Surgical at their new office near the Clearview Mall in Butler, toll-free 866-874-7483. That number again is 866-874-7483. Welcome, listeners. Nice to have you with us and on this upcoming segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. My name is Dave Malarkey, our guest, joining us by telephone, author and historian Stephen Pfeiffer. And we're going to be talking about, this is a great story, one that needs to be told. It's a story that relates to the history of the civil rights movement in our country. Let's first say hello to Steve Pfeiffer. We'll talk about his book in a second. Steve, nice to meet you. I really have looked forward to chatting with you.
Same here, Dave. Nice to meet you.
This is a year that we've already heard a lot about the history of the civil rights movement. We had the anniversary of Bloody Sunday, March 7th, 1965, not too long ago. Certainly a pivotal movement. Scenes of Alabama state troopers attacking peaceful demonstrators on that day. What a lot of us don't realize or don't know is why people were marching on that day to begin with. And that's what you've addressed in your book, right?
That's very true, Dave. Yes, in February of 1965, in Marion, Alabama, a small town about 30 miles away from Selma, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was holding voter registration efforts just as it was in Selma at the time. And an organizer for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference had been arrested, and the citizens of Marion were worried that he might be harmed in the jail. So after a rare evening rally, they decided to hold a march to the jailhouse. And the police and state troopers were waiting for them outside and turned the lights out on the street when the protesters came out of the church. The protesters knelt in prayer, and the police started just whacking them. And the protesters dispersed. Several of them ran to a local cafe, including a young man named Jimmy Lee Jackson. He was followed in there by state troopers. A scuffle ensued. He was shot. He died 8 days later. And as the town was mourning his death, someone said, "We should carry his casket from Marion to Montgomery and lay it on the steps of Governor George Wallace." That was eventually adapted to a march from Selma to Montgomery. And John Lewis, the esteemed congressman, has said, without Jimmy Lee Jackson, there'd have been no march and no Voting Rights Act.
Yeah, and this is something that, if not completely overlooked, certainly given short shrift in a lot of the accounts of the civil rights movement and accounts of Bloody Sunday, for that matter. The book that Steve Pfeiffer and his co-author, Derek Cohen, have written is entitled Jimmy Lee and James, Two Lives, Two Deaths, and the Movement That Changed America. Jimmy Lee obviously refers to the individual you were just talking about, Steve, Jimmy Lee Jackson. Who does the James in the title of your book refer to?
Well, the James is Reverend James Reeb. And one of the things that drew me to the subject, Dave, is, I mean, the names, Jimmy Lee and James, they kind of just stood out to me. They're right next to each other on the Civil Rights Memorial in Montgomery because they died so close to one another. And they're unknown, really, foot soldiers in the movement, and it's often these foot soldiers in movements and martyrs that change history. James Reeb, as opposed to Jimmy Lee Jackson, who was an African-American, high school-educated, $6-a-day pulpwood chopper, James Reeb was a Princeton Theological Seminary-educated white Unitarian minister from the North, who had left the Unitarian Church on leave to become a community organizer in Boston. And after Bloody Sunday, Dr. King called on Northern clergy to come and march with their brothers and sisters in Selma to successfully try and march to Montgomery. And Reverend Reeb was among those who answered the call. And on Tuesday, March 9th, just 2 days after Bloody Sunday, there was a short march. And after that march, many of the people who had come to Selma went out for dinner and were going to gather at a church to hear Dr. King talk about next plans. Reverend Reeb and two other Unitarian ministers were attacked as they came out of a cafe by white racist thugs. Reeb was clubbed, and he died 2 days later. And it was his death that led President Lyndon Johnson to go on TV a few days after that and say, "A good man has died in Selma. We need to pass the Voting Rights Act."
Hmm. It's difficult for us to look back on this history 50 years ago. I recently, Steve, listeners, if you join us a couple of minutes late, let me bring you up to date. Our guest, Steve Pfeiffer, joins us on the telephone today here on It's Your Turn. He is the author of a new book, co-author of a new book entitled Jimmy Lee and James, Two Lives, Two Deaths, the Movement That Saved, That Changed America. And it's the story behind the historic 1965 Voting Rights March from Selma to Montgomery. It's difficult for us to believe in the current day and age how recently this took place. Steve, I just did an interview earlier this year with the representative of the organization that still commemorates the legendary Tuskegee Airmen. They brought a restored aircraft to here to our area of western Pennsylvania, had a display and a video and so on. And it brought to mind something that a lot of us either forget or would like to forget. The U.S. Army during World War II was still segregated. We're not talking about just the Deep South. We're talking about the U.S. Army here.
Right.
They did not allow black African-Americans to serve alongside white people in the 40s, for goodness sakes. It's
right. And it's hard to believe that 50 years ago in Alabama, for example, that only about 2% of African-Americans were able to register to vote, and they had to jump through hoops to be able to do it because there were so many obstacles that were placed in their path, and that when they did attempt to register, they were subjected to violent action by either private citizens or even troopers or local police.
Let's talk a little bit about some of these obstacles, because this needs to be refreshed in our memory, and maybe for folks who don't know the reason why, we need to talk about this today, 50 years later. What were some of the obstacles that prevented African Americans from voting in the Deep South just 50 years ago? What roadblocks were put in their place?
Sure. Well, to put this in historical context, after the Civil War, during Reconstruction, African Americans in the South and throughout the country actually did have the right to vote. But when whites really regained the power in the South at the end of the 19th century, they enacted a number of what we now call Jim Crow laws that created these obstacles, Dave. These would include poll taxes, which rural blacks and others found very difficult to pay, literacy tests, which, again, were very difficult to pass, and then tests about the U.S. Constitution and other laws, and there were different tests for blacks and whites that the registrars had the option of giving, and that they were very, very difficult. So even if a person of color was able to read, they were often tested very difficult questions. And then after that, there were also subjective questions, and I kid you not, how many bubbles does a bar of soap produce? How many jelly beans are in that jar? And so those were the kind of institutionalized obstacles to voting. Then you had the fact that if someone registered to vote, their name was put in the local newspaper. This led to pressure from the white power structure on these people. So if you were an African-American who was sharecropping on white land or were employed by someone who was white, they would often tell these people, if you insist on registering to vote, you're not going to be able to live on our property or farm our property or come to work anymore.
We're talking, listeners, with Steve Pfeiffer, co-author of a book entitled Jimmy Lee and James. Available, I'm assuming, Steve, everywhere we get books these days, right?
I sure hope so, yes.
Mm-hmm. This is the story behind the historic 1965 Voting Rights March from Selma to Montgomery. We had mentioned that the story of Jimmy Lee Jackson and also James Reed is often overlooked when we're talking about the history of the civil rights movement. Is it ever addressed in some of the other media, film, for example, the film Selma? Did it address these two gentlemen, or was it glossed over in that film as well?
It's glossed over, although it is mentioned. The death of Jimmy Lee Jackson is and of Reverend Reeb are both portrayed very briefly, somewhat inaccurately, and I think that, to me, the disappointing thing in the film Selma was that the impression was given that Jimmy Lee Jackson was shot in Selma. And while this may not matter to filmgoers and to dramatic critics and so forth, I think it shortchanged the people of Marion who were putting themselves on the front line on a daily basis in this very small town. And the fact that there was no indication that this had happened there as opposed to Selma really, really hurt feelings there. With respect to Reverend Reeb, I have spoken to some of his colleagues who were disappointed that it played up the fact that he was a minister, because he had really taken leave from his ministerial duties and was doing community organizing in Boston. These are small, you know, changes made in the narrative, but for people who really know the story, they're deeply moved when those changes are made.
Listeners, we have a few more minutes that we're able to chat with Steve Pfeiffer about this very important part of our history, and certainly the history of the civil rights movement. We must take a quick break, though, so we'll do that, and we'll pick up our conversation with Steve here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
Choices, decisions, quality health care. These are important issues that really hit home. It's a good thing that Concordia Visiting Nurses is here to help. Home health care can help you or your loved one recuperate from an illness, manage a chronic disease, or recover from an injury or operation right in your own home. If you're in need of home health care, choose Concordia Visiting Nurses. Call toll-free at 1-877-352-6200.
Welcome back, listeners, on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest is Steve Pfeiffer, co-author of Jimmy Lee and James. Before we move on, Steve, a little bit about you for our listeners. Steve Pfeiffer is a New York Times best-selling author. He's written more than a dozen books, including his memoir, Three Quarters, Two Dimes, and a Nickel. Tell us a little bit about your co-author, Steve.
Well, I'm blessed in the fact that my co-author happens to be my son-in-law and also the best person qualified to work with me on this book. Adar Cohn is a young man who is the program director of the Civic Leadership Foundation here in the Chicago area, which works with disadvantaged youth. Adar has a long history of studying the civil rights movement, and he also teaches in the Peace Studies program at DePaul University, and he's actually the one who went down to Alabama and conducted interviews with many of the foot soldiers of the movement, people who had marched 50 years ago. A dozen of them, who were now in their 70s and 80s, gathered in a cafe in Marion and just told heartbreaking stories about their dedication to the movement all those years ago.
It seems almost impossible for us to believe 50 years later that it took so long for the civil rights, well, first of all, for the civil rights legislation to pass, for these things to change in the South. I mean, we have your story of Jimmy Lee Jackson and James Reeb. Look at all the others, Steve. Rosa Parks, the horrible situation with the students trying to get into the University of Alabama, Little Rock, Arkansas. And people today find it difficult to imagine why it possibly took so long back in the 60s for this movement to finally come to fruition in the Voting Rights Act.
Well, I think it's a chicken and egg thing. Because blacks didn't have the right to vote, they couldn't put people in place down there who could effect any political or social change. And so it took this, national movement to come down there and focus the nation's attention on what was going on. And therefore, as terrible as the Birmingham church bombing that killed those four little girls were, as terrible as those images of the dogs in Birmingham attacking children, as terrible as those images of Bloody Sunday are, and certainly as terrible as the deaths of Jimmy Lee Jackson and James Reeb, the two people we talk about in our book, were, they focused national attention and caused people in the North to push their legislators and their president to move swiftly to enact some kind of civil rights legislation and then voting rights legislation.
And it was Lyndon Johnson, who was president at the time, who finally really got behind this movement, correct?
Absolutely, yes. And that's one of the, I think, unfortunate portrayals in the movie Selma, which, by the way, I thought was a very powerful movie. But the suggestion in the movie that President Johnson somehow asked J. Edgar Hoover to send a sex tape to Coretta King that drove a wedge between her and Martin Luther King was really off base historically. That was J. Edgar Hoover doing that on his own.
And really, if you wanted to look at an administration that you could perhaps say dragged its feet a little bit, it would have probably been the Kennedy administration, not the Johnson administration.
Right. Yes, I think that's a very fair assessment. One thing I want to note here, Dave, that I think is important is about how the justice system dealt with these two murders. Jimmie Lee Jackson, in shades of something that exists today, his death was brought before, murder was brought before the grand jury down in Marion in 1965, both state and federal grand juries, and all white, and they refused to indict the state trooper. James Reeb's attackers were identified and brought to trial and acquitted by an all-white jury within 90 minutes. One of the jurors was the brother of the chief alibi witness. That's how Southern justice worked in those days. Mm-hmm. But remarkably, 40 years after the murder or death of Jimmie Lee Jackson, the case was revived by a district attorney down in Marion, in Alabama, and the state trooper was eventually indicted for murder and pled guilty to manslaughter charges. And we spend a good portion of the book talking about how justice was finally achieved for Jimmie Lee Jackson, albeit almost 50 years after the death.
In light of these, not just violence and brutality, but deaths, murders. Nonetheless, the civil rights leaders of the day maintained their strategy of nonviolence, and of course, well, the crucial roles there played by the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Do you talk about his role in organizing protests in your book, Steve?
Oh yes, very much so. He was asked to come in to Alabama at the beginning of 1965, because the effort there for voting rights had really stalled, and it was when Dr. King and many other people who were working with him in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and also the SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, when they really concentrated their efforts down there, that things started moving. And you're absolutely right, Dave, about the nonviolent aspect of this. Whenever there were these meetings in churches and people would then go out to protest, the organizers would say, if you cannot go out there and act nonviolently, then you stay in the church. We are not going to act in any kind of violent fashion. And they were, all the protesters were taught how to assume a position on the ground to protect themselves and not be combative, you know, kneeling and hands over the head. So if they were going to take body blows, which many of them often did, that they wouldn't go to the head. Unfortunately, Reverend Reeb was hit right on the side of the temple by a club or a baseball bat, and he had no chance of survival.
Let's bring this up to the present a little bit. You know, we have stories today of members, current members of Congress, who are asked to sign pledges, and if they dare vote even once against what's considered to be the line, they're, you know, immediately in danger of losing office. Was there anything comparable to this back in the days when the Voting Rights Act was coming before Congress, where the members of Congress at that time under this sort of pressure?
Not really. I think they really reflected so much the their constituencies in those days that the only real opposition to the Voting Rights Act, once it got going in 1965, was from Southern Democrats, and they had the full backing and blessing of their constituencies, and they were a minority, so that the legislation was able to be passed. However, currently, we do have Voting Rights Act legislation in Congress, and I think that's where we're seeing some representatives being hesitant to step forward and vote for a new Voting Rights Act that would reinstitute some of the provisions that were eliminated by the Supreme Court in a 2013 decision. And that 2013 Supreme Court decision has led to more restrictions on voting around the country, particularly in the South. And the legislation that could remedy that is stalled because of the same intransigent representatives of Congress who have blocked a lot of other legislation over the last 8 years.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you about that as a way to wrap up our conversation here today, because there was that Supreme Court decision, and it didn't take very long, did it, for some states in the South to immediately starting to tighten up again on these. I think it was North Carolina was one of the first states to immediately act.
North Carolina and Texas, within 24 hours of the Supreme Court decision, both of those states and then several other states in the South and the West, and even in the North, to be honest, started enacting stricter voter registration laws, restricting the hours that people could vote, making it more difficult to produce identification, and so forth. And what the Voting Rights Act of 1965 had done was require those states to demonstrate in advance that any changes they wanted to make in voting laws had to be pre-cleared with the federal government, the Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court eliminated that decision, so now the states don't have to clear any of these changes with the government. And Dave, I have to tell you, I talked with many of the people who were actually beaten on Bloody Sunday or who put themselves on the line back in the 60s, and they are devastated by what the Supreme Court did. And many of them said to me, those guys never stood in line to try and register to vote. Those guys never marched to try and get their civil rights. And those guys, meaning the Supreme Court, they're just so out of touch with history and even current events.
Well, it shows why it's so important that this story that Steve Pfeiffer writes about in Jimmy Lee and James is never forgotten, never glossed over. What about it, listeners? I know, you know, I was fairly well-versed on the civil rights movement, and yet I was hard-pressed to remember who these two gentlemen were, Jimmy Lee Jackson and James Reeb. So it's an important story that Steve Pfeiffer tells in his book. The title again is Jimmy Lee and James, Two Lives, Two Deaths, and the Movement That Changed America. Steve, thanks for talking with us today. Really enjoyed the conversation. It's an important story. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Dave.
One of our sponsors on the program today is Butler Motor Tours. Have you ever vacationed in New England? Boy, I have several times. Wonderful place to go. Nice and cool, beautiful. Love the White Mountains of New Hampshire, the Green Mountains of Vermont. Several trips to New England coming up through Butler Motor Tours, including a trip in September. This is a six-day trip entitled Islands, Whales, and Tales. It's a Cape escape to the shores of Cape Cod. That's right, the beautiful shores of Cape Cod with its charming villages and islands, lighthouses, and so much more. Also on this trip, enjoy a cruise to the island of Martha's Vineyard and see the unique cottages and homes there. Also, a trip to Nantucket Island. Oh, bye. You see it all, huh? This is September 17th through the 23rd. Check out the details on their website, butlerbus.com. Maybe you like to go on a cruise, but you don't like to fly to a seaport. No problem. They have several trips where you can take one of Butler Motor Tours' luxury coaches to Baltimore or New York, and then depart on your cruise from there. They're going to Bermuda by bus in September. There's a New England fall foliage crew in September as well. Both of those cruises sail from Baltimore. And much more, too. Hey, check it out. Their website is a terrific one. It's butlerbus.com. Pretty easy to remember. Butlerbus.com. For Butler Motor Tours, here's the thing. Their vacation trips are affordable. They're fun. They're comfortable. Butler Motor Tours. Online at butlerbus.com. Just a couple of weeks ago, we marked the anniversary of the 100th birthday of JFK. He was born on May 29th, 1917, 100 years ago. If he was still alive, he'd be 100. Coming up, a conversation with Tina Cassidy, not about JFK, but about Jackie, after Kennedy's death.
I wasn't prepared to be a caregiver to Mom, but a little over a year ago, we realized she couldn't take care of herself without our help. And, well, how could I not be there for her? I had no idea how hard it would be, and just what I would need to know. Things I never thought of, like how to improve her mood and, even for me, ways to stay positive. Luckily, I found the Caregiving Resource Center from AARP. It had articles about the basics that got me started, but also information about the hurdles I was facing in this new role. I could even connect with experts and hear from others who had been in my place. I know this road we're on isn't an easy one, but I'm really happy to have the extra help for her and for me.
Caregiving Resource Center at aarp.org/caregiving. Articles, tips, and tools to help you both care for your loved one and care for yourself. This message is brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Listeners, coming up on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. And by the way, if you're just joining us, my name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest is Tina Cassidy. She visits with us by telephone today. We're going to be talking about her new book entitled Jackie After O. First of all, Tina, nice to meet you. It's nice to talk with you for a few minutes today.
Likewise. My pleasure.
When we say Jackie After O, we, of course, are referring to Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, and we're talking about After O, After Onassis.
That's right. 1975 is the year that Onassis dies, and the book is really a tight 12-month narrative explaining how her life radically changes that year. She's a widow again for the second time at just 45 years old. Caroline is graduating from high school, so she's facing the empty nest syndrome. And she's looking out at the abyss of the rest of her life, trying to figure out what she should do to make herself happy.
It's kind of hard to realize for those of us who are baby boomers or older. We have personal memories of Jackie Kennedy and even some cases, childhood memories of JFK. But it's hard to put an age on that when you realize that here she was, a widow for the second time, and she was just 45.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
So she had another 20 years of life left to live, and, you know, this book chronicles her transformation in that year, but, you know, you talk about how different generations remember her and the Kennedys and the assassination and so forth. But I think that, you know, I'm a Gen Xer, so I'm a little bit younger than the boomers, but, you know, she even influences our culture today significantly. I mean, there are sunglass lines named after her, you know, Talbots is carrying a clothing line named after her. It goes on and on. But really, what I think is interesting about this year, 1975, for Jackie, is that she goes through a midlife crisis. Not surprisingly, she does it gracefully and with incredible style. And I think that that's something that anyone at midlife or beyond, anyone considering their third act, can relate to.
Not only a midlife crisis, but a real metamorphosis. I mean, up until this time, until 1975, she had been overshadowed, almost defined, really. It's unfair, but almost defined by powerful men. Certainly JFK, certainly Aristotle Onassis. What I did not realize until I read your book was her father was also a very powerful man. He was known as Black Jack Bouvier.
That's right. Yes, I mean, there was definitely a pattern in her life with her relationships with older men. She revered them and married them and so forth. But you know, there's a larger cultural context to this as well. Once she is no longer a wife in 1975, she looks around and sees that America is changing. Women are entering the workforce in the greatest numbers ever. You know, we were debating the Equal Rights Amendment. Watergate was ending. Vietnam was ending. Punk music was born that year. It was also the year of the hustle. So it was a year of great change, and she sensed that. And so she knew that there were new opportunities and new doors that were opening, and that it was actually okay for a woman, even of a certain social stratum, to go to work, not even because she needed the money, but because she needed a purpose. And 1975 is the year that basically Jackie gets a job, and that changed her life forever.
She, and there will be people in our listening audience, Tina, who are not tremendously familiar with her background. And by the way, I hope I pronounced Bouvier correctly. My French is horrendous. That was her family name. Was her family wealthy? I mean, did she come from a background where she had never had to work up until this point?
Yes, well, her father had been a stockbroker, but he lost everything in the Depression. He was also a bit of a cad and was cheating on her mother, so they got divorced. But her mother married an Auchincloss, so this is the family with standard oil wealth, and they had a giant home in Newport and another large estate in Virginia. And so Jackie did grow up surrounded by wealth, but they were sort of cash poor, if you will. They were house rich and cash poor, and you know, she came from a big family, so I think she had access to privilege, but also between what happened in the Depression and her her stepfather's sort of dwindling fortune in later years, you know, she was always worried about money.
So her family was from the Newport area. I assume that's how she met Jack Kennedy.
Well, actually, Jackie was originally from New York. Her family had a great history there, and her grandfather was a developer in New York City. He had built 740 Park Avenue, which even today is one of the most expensive and lavish luxury co-op buildings in the city. So she was from New York, but when her mother remarried, that's when she got pulled to Newport and Virginia. She was a teenager at that time. But New York was always her home.
A little bit about the previous transformation, because I think we need to talk about that to understand how the public would accept her, in your words, I love it, getting a job.
Right.
You know, when JFK was assassinated, it was an earth-shattering event here in this country. The funeral and everything was covered nonstop, 24 hours by television, which was not done back in those days in the early 60s. And the public, I'm truncating here for the interest of time, I think it's fair to say the general public was absolutely shocked, flabbergasted, when a relatively short time later she announced she was going to get married to Aristotle Onassis.
Yeah, I mean, I think, 5 years later, in 1968, she married Onassis, but she had known him for many years. In fact, had first met him on his ship in the Mediterranean with JFK, when Kennedy was just a senator still. It's a really fascinating story about how Onassis had heard that the Kennedys were in the area, and he had Winston Churchill aboard his boat, his yacht, I should say. And JFK really wanted to meet Churchill, and likewise, but Churchill was quite elderly at that point and didn't know who JFK was when he arrived, and JFK was really disappointed because, as Jackie described that night, she said Churchill had gone gaga.
We're talking, listeners, those of you who may have joined us a few minutes late on this segment of It's Your Turn, we're talking with author Tina Cassidy, specifically about her book, Jackie After O. Is it just recently published, Tina?
Yes, it just came out this week.
And available in all the places where we would find books these days. Again, the title,
Indeed.
Jackie After O. Is it fair to say that in the public's eye, at least up until 1975, she had been almost an unreal figure, an icon, and now she changes into a real person, a flesh and blood woman.
Yes, she really does. I think that she was tired of being an icon, and she wanted to have a life like other people did. And 1975 is the year that she tries to achieve that. Getting a job was certainly one aspect of that. You know, there are some great stories about how in the office, in her first job in publishing, which she gets later that year, you know, she's making coffee at the office and making her own copies. And, you know, there was no security in the publishing office. People just came right in. And, you know, she was down on the floor on her hands and knees, spreading out photo spreads and asking questions in meetings that, you know, everyone else knew the answers to, like what does flush left, ragged right mean? And these are publishing terms about how you print words on a page and so forth. So she had a lot to learn. She wasn't afraid to dive in. And, you know, just be a regular person.
We'll take a quick break. We have a few more minutes to continue our conversation with the journalist Tina Cassidy. And we will do so right after this break on It's Your Turn on WISR. We'll be right back.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 01. The pick 3, 910. The pick 4, 7563. The pick 5, 23039. And the treasure of the wild ball for each of those is 1. The treasure hunt, 3, 12, 13, 19, and 29. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $50,000.
Moving from my home of 50 years was a little scary, but I wasn't safe at home anymore, and my daughter with her busy life, children and grandchildren, it wasn't fair for me to expect so much from her.
We looked together to find a new home and discovered New Haven Court at Clearview.
What made the difference were the employees and the residents we met. The residents said it was a great place to live.
New Haven Court at Clearview, a great place to live because it's a great place to work. 888-261-5753 or visit IntegraCare.com.
Welcome back, listeners. Dave Malarkey is my name. You're listening to It's Your Turn on WISR. Our guest, author Tina Cassidy, joins us by telephone today. We're talking about her brand new book, Jackie After O, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis After Aristotle Onassis. There's another thing we should talk about, and then I want to get to her work in publishing. I think it's one of the reasons why people had this image that they did of her. She was always, even though she was in public, she was quiet. She was, you know, this very demure. In fact, she had a kind of a little girl voice when you heard her speak. The famous White House tour that she gave on TV.
Yes, and the people who knew her personally say that was really an affectation, and that she sounded like anybody else who had an old New York accent. You know, it was much sort of deeper and rougher. So I think that it could have been nerves, but also an affectation when she sounded that way. And that, you know, that's one of the things that I found really interesting. She had this perception of being, you know, really more style than substance, and I think that her voice was one of the reasons why people thought that. But 1975 is the year that she really flowers intellectually. I mean, she was incredibly smart. She had, you know, read Gone with the Wind several times before she was 12. She wrote poetry as a child. You know, she had been a newspaper columnist briefly and a very good one until JFK proposed to her, and then she quit. And so 1975 is the year that she brings this all back out and really puts it to use.
How did she get her first job in publishing?
Well, she decided that she needed to do something to occupy her mind and her time, and she went looking for a job on the suggestion of a friend, an old friend, Tish Baldrige, who had been her social secretary at the White House. She and Tish had lunch in Washington one day, and Tish was shocked to see how depressed Jackie looked. Tish said that Jackie's voice even was drooping. And Tish had always worked, even at a time when women weren't expected to work, and, you know, believed that it was an important part of of life for anybody who felt they had something to give. And Tish said, you know, you should go into publishing, and Jackie considered it and agreed, and went out pretty quickly thereafter, knocking on doors. The first place she went was Random House in New York, a great publisher, and she met with Jason Epstein, and he basically said, no, you can't have a job here. Huh. I have many other young people in line to be an editor. They've worked hard, they put in their time, they went to school for this, and he couldn't see how he could fairly give her a job when she didn't know the first thing about being an editor.
But she, if I could just think of, you know, that an administrative assistant comes to the door of the boss and says, Jackie Kennedy's here to see you. Oh, yes, right, yeah.
Right. They had this conversation over a magnificent French lunch at a five-star restaurant called Lutèce. And Jason Epstein, whom I interviewed for this book, you know, can recount every forkful of food he had that lunch and says that he regrets to this day that he didn't hire her.
Hmm.
He had no idea that, of course, that she would go on to have a wonderful publishing career for 20 more years and do some incredible books, including Michael Jackson's autobiography and books with Carly Simon and others. She had some bestsellers there in the 100 books that she published.
Hadn't she written a piece, an unsigned piece that appeared in New Yorker magazine, a Talk of the Town piece?
Yes, that's one of the first things that she does in 1975. As Onassis's health is failing, she starts to ramp up this idea that she needs to do something on her own. And writing is something that she always did and always loved. And so she offers this piece to the New Yorker, and it appears in one of the January issues of 1975. And she was really delighted by that. And I think that she had hoped to write more for the New Yorker, but some other things started to unfold that captured her attention that year.
She did have earlier a brief stint as an intern at a national magazine, right, at Vogue?
She did, yes. Her mother encouraged her while she was in college to write for a contest that would result in an internship. Of course, she won out of many, many, many applicants. And her Vogue application is a wonderful document to read. It really shows, her talent and her eye and her vision. And I think that what is reflected there in that application is the same qualities that would make her a great editor later in life.
She was, you mentioned that she was a brilliant, and she was a student of history and of architecture. She was very knowledgeable there. In fact, that was one of her campaigns after 1975. It was a pretty high-profile campaign to save Grand Central Terminal.
Absolutely. So, as I was saying, you know, she had an article appear in the New Yorker in early January of 75, but later in that same month, she read a story on the front page of the New York Times saying that Grand Central Terminal was being threatened by a redevelopment proposal by the railroad, and this really alarmed her. Because she was from New York and her family had a great history there, and because she loved old buildings, she didn't think that that was a good idea for the city to destroy a gorgeous Beaux-Arts building, especially since Pennsylvania Station had been torn down some years before to make way for the rather grotesque Madison Square Garden. So she thought this was a building worth saving, and she became front and center as part of this battle, you know, using her obvious political and publicity abilities to get people's attention. I think that because of that battle, she got people across America interested in historic preservation at a time when urban renewal was rampant and we were tearing down old buildings to put up modernist buildings from coast to coast.
Apart from her professional life after O, 1975, do you talk about her personal life in your book, Jackie After O? I mean, she was, after all, a single parent.
She was a single parent. You know, it was really hard for, she was very close to her children. It was very hard for her to let go of Caroline. Caroline leaves for, she graduates from Concord Academy that June and leaves for London in the fall. And that was a very difficult transition for Jackie. I mean, as it is for any parent. to have your first child grow up and leave like that. But she was especially nervous for Caroline. She was an ocean away. You know, she was a Kennedy after all, and Jackie was always concerned about people trying to harm her and her kids. And Caroline, she had good reason to be concerned. Shortly after Caroline arrived in London, she was staying with a minister of parliament, and he was basically attacked by an IRA bomb.